This program was first broadcast on Canterbury's access media station, Plains FM, and was made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.
Kia ora koutou and welcome to Legally Speaking with me, Duncan Webb, a show where we get in-depth about law, order and everything in between. I'm a former Professor of Law and a current Member of Parliament, and I'm a keen advocate for getting informed about your rights. I'm here to get into the nitty-gritty of justice in Aotearoa.
Legally Speaking is funded by Parliamentary Services.
Kia ora, I'm Georgie, producer of Legally Speaking with Duncan Webb. Today we're discussing climate change. We have a fantastic panel of experts who Duncan will introduce shortly. Our panel will be discussing issues like water quality, oil exploration, Christchurch climate issues, and more. We will also be answering questions sent in by you, our audience. If you'd like to ask questions for future podcasts, follow Duncan Webb on Facebook and Instagram. Okay, that's enough of me. Over to you, Duncan.
Today we've got two fantastic guests with us. Our first is Professor Travis Horton from the University of Canterbury School of Earth and Environmental Sciences in the Faculty of Science. Now, I've got your bio here, and it tells me that your research includes astrobiogeophysical things, which is an exo-Earth system science. So if this is a podcast about simplifying complex ideas, how do we go about simplifying that?
Well, I'm also a lecturer, so I'm good at breaking things down to the key ingredients and then building it back up again. But basically, that means that I study how the Earth works as a system.
Right. Well, that was a lot shorter.
Yeah.
No, hey, look, it's so good to have you in here today and looking forward to having a chat about things climate.
Cheers.
And we've also got Beatrix Gilling, a young climate change activist. And I see, Beatrix, that you are part of Greater Otatahi, which I'm told is an advocacy group for more neighbours, better active transport and better public transport. More neighbours. That's not what everyone wants.
No, it's not, but someone's got to advocate for them, and we're the ones to do that.
So you're a yes in my backyard?
Absolutely.
Oh, it's great to have you here, and I'm looking forward. And you said you couldn't make the school strike for climate, but you're a big supporter.
Oh, yeah, a big supporter, but, you know, you've got to pay the rent, so.
Good to see. David Seymour would be happy that you're out there working. All right, I couldn't help myself. I'm sorry. I am a politician. It is a political podcast, at least in some ways. Hey, it's so good to have you both in here and, you know, to have some input into some of these tricky questions. And look, climate change is, you know, being said, well, my former boss Jacinda said it was, you know, our nuclear moment, biggest challenge facing us. One of the challenges is the kind of size and breadth of it, isn't it? How do we communicate the kind of breadth of the challenge in a way that doesn't become overwhelming?
Well, it does get overwhelming for many of us, and I think that's a key part of breaking it back down to the local and the individual. So how do you bring it back so it doesn't become too stressful and overwhelming? Think about your local actions and how having less water might impact you, because that's part of the climate change scenario, the climate change crisis, really. Your plants might change. You know, the animals and the organisms in your environment will be behaving different ways. You might not be able to get the same type of food at certain times of the year. So, you know, think about how you might become more resilient in the face of that dynamic system, how that change might impact you. It can still become incredibly stressful. So the key that I try to give my students at the University of Canterbury is a little bit of hope and thinking about, okay, there are solutions to this and there are things that we can do.
Yeah, Beatrix, I guess hope, people can't necessarily see you. You're a little younger than some of the other people in the room. And I guess that's one of the things that things like School Strike for Climate and young person's activism really points out, right, that there's a sense of desperation out there. I mean, do you have any views on kind of climate change has so many strands to it. Where do you think we should be looking?
I think, at least when it comes back to that kind of hope aspect, I always like to focus on the actionable steps that we can take today. And so that, for me, when I'm particularly passionate about getting young people involved and getting young people knowledgeable on how they can have an impact, have their voice heard. And so that's as simple as trying to get people to send an email to a local counselor to be like, hey, I'd like to be able to bike easier to school in some way. And just actually looking at those actionable steps that we can take of things we can do now, and then we can look towards the future in terms of things that we can do in the future. We just have to keep doing our best.
And I guess, do you have a view, Beatrix, on the balance between those big questions we've heard in the news today about methane emissions on farm, for example, and those much smaller things like you catching the bus here today? I mean, how do we maintain the pressure on both of those things?
Yeah, I mean, when it comes to those big issues, that really takes us needing to have that deeper conversation, obviously, and having that conversation at that national level around what kind of regulations should be put in place, as well as, you know, having conversations actually with farmers and farming communities in terms of what is possible to do right now to cut those emissions. I mean, something I've heard of is in terms of genetic engineering, in terms of making grasses that produce less methane in the cow's stomachs. Something like that could be a possibility in the future.
Because I guess this is the point, right? There's a huge, Travis, the challenge is enormous, global in scale. And coming from a science background, of course, I'm hoping you're interested in evidence and solutions. I mean, what part do you think, well, what are the challenges for having science-based solutions?
Challenges for science-based solutions are really scaling it up to the size of the emergency, the size of the crisis. You know, gigatons of carbon, 40 gigatons going up every year.
What's a gigaton? This is the problem, right?
Exactly.
A gigaton is just a word to a simple lawyer like me.
Yep.
What does it actually mean? How much carbon is that?
It's a billion tons, so it's a trillion kilograms. So that's the challenge, is the scale of the problem globally is so large that no human can understand it, scientist or otherwise. It's just incredibly big. So the more we can get those local to individual based changes of behavior, keeping the positive and finding the hope, building some regulatory frameworks around things like trying to reduce the emissions from transport, reduce the emissions from agriculture, but also find solutions for removing the carbon from the atmosphere itself. So there's clear science evidence for how we can remove carbon from the atmosphere. There's really novel things happening right here in Christchurch. But scaling that up is what I would say is the immediate challenge to the science, getting it so it actually starts having an appreciable impact, considering how big the current issue is.
So I guess one of the challenges, you know, and I sat on the chair of the Environment Committee when the climate change legislation went through, and one of the challenges is the sense of urgency, right? Because politicians generally have a 3-year horizon and we're asked to tackle 50 and 100-year problems. The language around the climate is the language of crisis. Beatrix, is that the right language to be using? Is it a crisis?
It definitely is a crisis. In saying that, we as humans have difficulty understanding long-term crisis. And that's what climate change is. It's a long-term crisis. It needs action now, and it needs action in the future, and it needed action in the past. It's not as simple as an earthquake where some buildings fall down, a lot of people get hurt, but we can rebuild and we can try and recuperate from that. This is a long-term problem that we're going to live with for the rest of our society as humanity.
And I guess the other problem is, you know, we walk out the door and life seems normal from one day to the next. Yet we do know that both in New Zealand and I guess our Pacific neighbours as well are suffering real and direct effects of climate change. Beatrix, again, what do you think about our obligations to the kind of wider community, including the Pacific?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's really the whole the whole issue for most of New Zealand in terms of when it comes to climate change is we are supposed to be this responsible green country in the world, and we've actually not been. And now we have Pacific neighbors who are facing severe flooding with increased water level rises. We're going to see that in our own backyard. You look at South Shore. There's a whole bunch of new builds going up there, and we're going to see increased flooding risk there from ocean level rise. It's something that we really have to build our own responsibility for, because we've set ourselves up as this great place.
I mean, one of the challenges, Travis, is we're halfway through this crisis, right, by some measures at least. And as Beatrix just said, there's building going on and adaptation going on. To what extent do you think we should be accepting the inevitable and building for a changing environment? And to what extent do you think there's purpose in winding the clock back?
Yeah, it's the classic, you know, mitigation versus adaptation argument.
That's exactly it.
And personally, when I was an undergraduate student, you know, Beatrix's age, I was very much in the mitigation, you know, act now. This is back in the 1990s. You know, we knew that this was a really serious problem and that we really needed to act then. And now that I'm a little bit older, I think we do need to balance. We do need to be adapting and strategically planning for the dynamic change that will be happening in the future. So that's kind of adaptation. But at the same time, there's lots of good that can come from really strong mitigation, reducing those emissions, changing the behaviors. And, you know, I fully agree with Beatrix that it is a crisis. And when you think about this on Earth timescales, like geological timescales, and this is completely unprecedented. The speed with which humans are changing Earth's climate system is orders of magnitude thousands of times faster than anything has ever happened naturally. And it's because of the speed that it does become a crisis.
Because that is one of the, in some circles, there's a narrative that climate change, that the Earth's climate has changed across many thousands and millions of years, and there's plenty of evidence for that. But what you're telling us from, you know, your scientific background is that may be true, but not like this. Is that the guts of it?
Yeah, I have this discussion with my dad all the time.
I'm glad to see we've all got relatives who we have these discussions with.
It's a really heated, robust discussion, as it should be. But yes, Earth's climate system is naturally dynamic. It does change. You know, you've got orbital, the Earth, sun, the amount of radiation. In the past, the equivalent of fossil fuel burning has happened. Back about 55 million years ago, the ocean belched out an incredible amount of methane. It caused about 6-7 degrees C of warming, but over about 14,000 years, but we're talking, you know, degrees over centuries. So it's really that speed that makes it completely unprecedented and a real crisis. And back to the Pacific just for a second, because one of the things that I don't think many listeners and, you know, people in any country fully appreciate is the Pacific Island nations, they're largely reliant upon their coral reef systems. You know, they're old volcanoes that, you know, had a coral reef around the outside of them, and then the volcano might have gone back down in the ocean and the reef remained, and that's kind of an atoll. Or you have places like Rarotonga, where the effectively the old volcano is still there, and you get the mountainous interior. Either way, those systems are really reliant on those coral reefs. That's one of the most endangered animals on the planet today because of the carbon dioxide going into the air that then goes into the ocean, which decreases the ocean's pH. It makes the ocean more acidic. The coral dissolves, and we're talking 50 years is what the scientists are saying, until the ocean is so acidic that we won't have corals growing anymore. That will become beyond a crisis. That's the turning point.
Atolls will actually just disappear, quite apart from sea level rise.
The ecosystems will collapse relatively quickly. And it's the type of thing where if we're not acting now to get that carbon out of the atmosphere, the ocean will acidify and those minerals will eventually dissolve. So it's the type of thing where to me, that's the science knowledge that I have and I try to impart to my students, that try to bring home that this is a really important crisis. Now let's get back to the positive of, you know, how can we fix it? How can we act now to actually solve it?
Yeah. And I guess one of the challenges kind of coming from my perspective is that the burden, both in New Zealand and around the world, seems to fall on those least equipped to manage it, right? Whether it's the Pacific Islands or the Delta of Bangladesh, or even our own communities. So I was over on the West Coast, which suffers some real problems, north of Westport and in Westport. These are all our less wealthy communities. There's a political problem of assisting there as well. What do you think about that, Beatrice?
I think that is a core issue of climate change, that the people who will be affected most are often the people with less resources to deal with it.
Yeah. And I mean, if you think about the political decisions that are made every day, I mean, at the moment, our council's working through its long-term plan and, you know, there's demands of all kinds on it, whether it be libraries or cathedrals. God forbid, and then on top of that, we've got the expectation that the council will take decisions around climate change. What sort of things can councils do about climate change mitigation in particular?
Well, I had a quick read of the long-term plan. I'm not an expert in it. I'll admit that up front. But one of the things that I did like, the words were good. You know, they're talking about adaptation. They're talking about mitigation. Climate and resilience is right up there in the top five issues for the future, right alongside rates and basic services. But what are they doing? You know, I looked at a few of the plots, and one of the things that really kind of encouraged me was, if you can believe the planning of the next several years in the capital spend, there's a lot of money that'll be going into stormwater and flood resilience. It right now, it's one of the smallest pieces of the capital spend for the city council, but 10, 20 years from now, it's actually the biggest chunk of the planned capital spend. And with sea level rise, when that sea level rises, the groundwater table rises. So the rivers start behaving differently. They're going to a whole new, what we call base level. The height at which they erode to is different. They actually start aggrading or rising up. That natural process dramatically increases the flood hazard.
They're massive issues, aren't they? It's a huge amount of engineering work, both to understand it and then to address it. Beatrix, what do you think in terms of local councils and the spend that's going on and the climate crisis that we've identified? What would you say to councillors around the table who are choosing where to put their money?
Well, I think the biggest loss, especially in this long-term plan, is the pushing back of major cycle route connections. There's so many planned cycleways that have been pushed back, and those cycleways in particular are important because they're connective cycleways. There's one, the Southern Lights, which would connect all of Beckenham and other lower southern suburbs to the major cycleways that have already been somewhat established throughout the city. And that connectivity is really important because if you don't have that connection through a network, then that network's not going to be used because it's a useless network.
Yeah, I mean, I had thought that the discussion around cycleways had moved on, right? Because this was a discussion of 6 or 7 years ago. I mean, what do you say to those people who still talk about cycleways being a disruption and a nuisance and, taking up valued parking and things like that?
The valued parking is, for one, it's council subsidizing cars. It's council giving, I think it's on average, $2,500 a year in free parking, essentially. Whereas when you introduce cycleways, you get huge health benefits for people, a better connection to their community, you get greater happiness, as well as you're getting people out of cars and onto bikes and other more...
Well said. And I'll give a shout out for walking as well. You know, it's not the bikes aren't the only way to get around. It's great to have a community where you can walk down to the shops and walk to your school and things like that. And I'm a big one for designing cities that people can walk to where they need to go wherever possible.
I'll tell you what, I'm really glad that I ride my bike to work every day because it just keeps me fit. This past weekend, I went up and did 20 Ks hiking in the hills right around the Marlborough-Tasman border. And holy cow, I was just exhausted, but there's no way I could have been able to get out there and enjoy that Aotearoa environment firsthand had I not maintained, you know, regular activity. And cycling for me is it's keeping me well, keeping me healthy. It's great.
That's the other thing. Those side benefits are significant. So I'm a keen cyclist myself and a keen hiker. So there you go. Maybe we'll have to do an outdoors show as well.
There we go.
We're probably not experts on this, but there's a lot going on in Canterbury. Canterbury's been talked about in terms of the land use that goes on. And Te Waihora Lake Ellesmere here is well known as one of our least healthy waterways, right? At the same time, we've got an economy that's at least in part based on exporting primary products, right? Milk products, beef, sheep. Now, is there a balance to be struck there, or do we need to rethink what our economy is built on? What do you think about that, Beatrice?
I think there's, for one, there's definitely some pulling back that needs to happen. But I think there is possibility to find ways to adapt the way that we engage in agriculture, the way that we engage in primary industry to not destroy our waterways. I mean, it's something like 80%. I'm not going to keep that figure, but a huge amount of our waterways are unswimmable, whereas they used to be swimmable 20 years ago.
Yeah, the current, if I've got it right, the current environmental standards place kind of water quality at the top of the kind of pyramid of expectations, whereas the new government, the new minister, Penny Simmons, wants to have a flat approach where kind of economic use is put on the same par as environmental protection. What do you think about that, Travis? Is that a feasible approach?
To me, that would not be sustainable in the long term. I don't think having the economic value set on par with the environmental one is a sustainable proposition based on prior history, based on prior activity. So in my brain, there's a pretty significant rebalancing that needs to happen out there with the agricultural economy. And, you know, the way I teach this to my students is you wouldn't put a dairy farm in the Sahara Desert, would you? Like, well, no, there's not enough water. It's a water intensive sort of thing, growing a lot of grass for cows to make, you know, milk. Like, all right, well, where's the balance point? Where is it actually a sustainable practice? How many stock per land area would you put on? And it's not going to be the same number in the Waikato as it is in Westland or Southland or the Canterbury Plains. And Canterbury Plains it's dry. It's on a net hydrologic deficit, science words. It means there's more evaporation every year than rain going in.
Right.
And the groundwater gets used to keep the agricultural productivity up for economic driver comes from the rivers. Actually, it's coming from the side rather than top down out of rainfall. So it's a really complex system. And in my brain, scientifically, data-based kind of brain, there is a big rebalancing that needs to happen in certain places based on the environmental context.
So you'd be an advocate of not intervening a great deal by things like significant irrigation projects, which take water either from the water table or rivers to make otherwise arid land more arable. Would that be a fair summation of your view, or...?
That's a very fair summation of my personal opinion on it. I moved here in 2007, and Central Plains water was the big issue pre-earthquake. You know, this was the thing. And, you know, our democratically elected councillors at ECAN were going slow with resource consents because the Rakaia Selwyn catchment is just one example, was 145% allocated. They were, you know, going slowly because we might not actually have the water that the farmers are asking for to intensify the agricultural system. So taking the water out of the rivers, it might allow for increased agricultural productivity, but what it does, those rivers leak into the ground, and that's Christchurch drinking water. So you're taking the water out of the river and cutting off the tap to our drinking water supply in what's a city that's just gone through a 10-year-long plus recovery.
I guess Beatrix, still talking about farming a little bit, I suspect we're all city folks here, but obviously farming's important, isn't it? And, we need food and we want effective and efficient food production. We can't have hobby farms feeding the nation and our exporters. How do you think we need to address this? Because what we absolutely can't have is kind of alienating our farmers who are doing, a good job and I think by and large really want the same outcomes everyone else does.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not the best equipped to answer this, but in my view, I see that we need to find the targets that we need to hit and then approach farmers and say, you need to hit these targets by 2035. How are you going to do that? And we'll help you to hit those targets.
So you think, because this was one of the challenges in the last government, was that, the degree to which government should be providing both tools and in some cases finance for farmers and other high carbon industries, high emitting industries, to kind of improve their outcomes. Do you think there's a place for that?
I think there is a place for that in terms of that kind of adaptation and mitigation of climate change.
Yeah, I mean, the current government's view, and Travis, you may want to comment on this, is that emissions trading is how you do it, that you make people pay for their carbon and other emissions, and their behaviour will follow the market. Is that a useful approach, Travis?
It'll probably lead to a fair bit of inequality and injustice, in my opinion. As soon as you put a price tag on it, it's going to become an incredible burden on some, whereas those who have, they can just keep doing the same behaviour and just paying for it. Now, I don't think putting a price on it is particularly the best way to go. And I also don't think that telling farmers to meet a target is necessarily the right way either. Because I've been working with farmers for 17 years, and holy cow, they are some of the most passionate environmentalists, most committed people. They know the land, they know their environment, they know their soil, they know their plants. They know why one side of the paddock behaves a different way to the other side of the paddock. The knowledge and understanding of the farmers within their own context is really strong and really powerful. They get a lot of pressure financially to just pay off the huge mortgages they have for the equipment, for the land. It becomes a financial need to intensify and put more product out. So adding in another cost by buying carbon emissions.
The targets aren't the answer. Yeah. Is there something we can do or the government can do to assist in a transition to a much lower carbon farming and lower emitting farming framework?
Personally, I would say we need to shift towards polycultures rather than monocultures. It becomes a much more water sustainable sort of way to cultivate land, rather than just having huge paddocks of just grass for just cows or sheep or whatever. Have multiple agricultural products within the environment, trees alongside the brush, alongside the grazing animals, have multiple things that a farmer in a particular piece of land is actually putting to a market, a local market, not necessarily an export international market. That slightly more complex system becomes more sustainable, not only for the economics of the individual, but also more sustainable with respect to the carbon footprint, the water footprint, et cetera.
Yeah. Okay. Well, there's some, that would be quite a transformation, but an interesting prospect.
Got to start somewhere.
Yeah, that's right. Absolutely. I've got a couple of more topics before we want to move on to some questions. And one of those, Beatrix, I'm sure you've got an opinion on, SailGP. Go on. You've seen all the scandal, the racing called off and Russell throwing his toys and saying he's never coming back, he's dumping us. What do you think? Should we be having the Formula One of racing in Lyttelton Harbour, or have you not got much interest?
To be honest, I'm not that interested. Having events here is nice. It's a nice to have, but protecting our environment is more important, and protecting our endangered species, our wildlife is more important.
So I'm not sure if you followed the detail, but our mayor, Phil Major, suggested that perhaps we should just tweak the rules around, the legislation around marine mammal protection, so that we could make racing a bit easier. Have you got any comments for Phil Major?
Phil, I think you're wrong there.
Okay. Any comments, Trevor?
He's definitely wrong there.
Okay,
the Marine Mammal Act is 40, 50 years old. These are endangered taonga, treasured organisms. There are ways I think you could have your cake and eat it too, though, because I have followed the sailing, and you know, I wasn't originally into the foiling thing, but it is exciting.
Oh, look, no, I do a bit of sailing, and it's an impressive technology. But you've got a special interest in marine mammals, is that right? You've got some knowledge around whale navigation and the like.
I do a lot of humpback whale, pikia conservation research in Rarotonga. I do a little bit of that here in Aotearoa, New Zealand. We use drones, fly the drones over the marine mammals, and we use infrared cameras to get their heartbeat, their body temperature, their respiration rate, understand how healthy they are. We put satellite tracking devices on to figure out where they're going, why they're going there, why they're stranding, these types of things. But you know, for Hector's dolphins and moas up north, much more critically endangered moas up north, they're fast and they're curious and they'll come up to boats, but a foiling sailboat going 190 Ks, you know, those dolphins can only swim maybe 50, right? So to me, if you're going to have it, you have a change in the way the boats behave. It's like, oh, the sighting of a dolphin, off your foils.
I think at the moment we've probably struck the balance about right, which is if you see there's dolphins in the harbor, let's just cool it off for a bit until they go away. Even if they do want to have a bit of a play for an hour or two.
That seems pretty
And I think most people in Christchurch were happy with that. That's awesome. All right. Well, we've got time to move to some questions that have been – is that about right, do you think, Georgie?
Yeah, that is perfect timing. It is question time. So we put the call out on our Facebook and Instagram for some questions that people had about climate change. The first one, which we've kind of talked a little bit already about, but how can we shift the narrative surrounding climate change to a positive and more forward-thinking one?
Well, highlight companies like Aspiring Materials and really get in behind those types of companies. You know, Christchurch company that has shown how to remove carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere and put it back into what we call the long-term carbon cycle. So the fossil fuel burning, putting it up there, then take that CO2 and react it with certain types of minerals that then pulls the carbon dioxide right back out again. Give people a real, concrete, relatively straightforward scientific demonstration of how we can solve this alongside highlighting how changing your behavior to riding your bike makes you happier, like for me.
Beatrice, young people, not every young person's a climate activist. How do we make sure that we've got them on side for the future?
I think that involves education and making sure that people actually know what is going on, what the actual scale of the problem is. But also, as I said at the beginning, looking at what those actionable steps are for them to take in their own lives. And I mean, it's not an individual problem, but seeing what you can do as an individual is good. It's good for the heart, good for the mind when dealing with big problems.
And I must say, your comment earlier on about emailing the decision makers, whether it be about cycleways or whatever, it's really important that people are politically engaged. And I don't think people need to think of it as political engagement, but just having their say and letting their views be known. Because I can say from my perspective that it does actually make a difference, and we need to make sure that that's a discussion that's in the political arena as well.
Kind of moving on with the same kind of topic, but how do you deal with climate change anxiety, particularly when you have young children?
I have five kids. Maddie's 18 and Johnny's 6. We spread them out every 3 to 4 years. So we have I've had young children for well over 10 years now. It's hard. it's really hard because the media, and even as a scientist, it's really hard to just not get overwhelmed by the stress of the problem. So what we do in our house is we just focus on wellness and you know, holistic well-being. We don't talk about and think about tangible wellness. You know, we get them outside, experiencing nature, appreciating the wind blowing through the trees and the cool sound it makes. Just being kind of a sense of place becomes really empowering for young people. And then, you know, getting them fired up to ride their scooter, ride their bike from a young age. Our kids are always on their bikes and their scooters, and that's just so built into their day-to-day routine that they're probably going to be cyclists for as long as they can. That's awesome.
Beatrix, I mean, it's important to not catastrophize, but at the same time, neither do we want complacency. Do you think this is a problem in young people? And if so, what do we do about it?
I don't think it's a particularly widespread problem, but I know I've definitely seen issues of people going, there is nothing that we can do to stop climate change. It's going to happen and we're all doomed and that's the end of it. We might as well just keep driving SUVs and destroying the planet because it's going to happen anyway, which is the worst way to think about it, in my opinion. I think that the main way to kind of get off of that climate anxiety is to just actually get outside, as you were saying, either like in terms of actively just doing things in terms of cycling and all of that kind of stuff, taking the bus, having a walk around the neighborhood, or you know, actually getting involved to an extent in and around people who are also trying to make some kind of a difference. I think that's a really helpful thing for the mind. Having community, having a connection with other people, whether that's a very focused thing or a more spread out in terms of your actual neighbors and all of that kind of thing.
Awesome. And I'll give it a crack at asking a question. This is what I've touched on, but you know, in terms of how do we go about balancing a sustainable environment and a functioning economy, you know, because both are important, right? What do you think about that, Beatrix? You got a view on that?
Yeah, I mean, in my view, I'd say that it is possible to have both. We can have both, and the only thing that's stopping us from getting there is, honestly, it's political will.
So it's me.
It's you.
Okay. Give me some backbone. Get on with my job.
Yeah.
Okay. What do you think, Travis? It's got to be done, right?
Yeah.
At the same time, the economy, do we have to kind of reconceptualize what our economy is? An economy isn't necessarily all steel and cars, right? And there's a whole lot of production that can go on because the economy is just producing well-being. Mm. That's what it is. We think about wealth, but all wealth is really things that make people's lives better. And some of us think the way to make our lives better is to trip to Europe for the winter, right? Whereas there's a lot more low-carbon ways to make our lives just as good. And maybe we need to start thinking about that.
Yeah, personally, I'm not an economic growth fan. So the rebalancing to me, you know, I just dislike growth models, but more on point to your question, you know, my wife did her PhD in well-being. This was 14 odd years ago. And when she interviewed students and their fauna and their teachers and the communities, money didn't show up. It was relationships. It was the skills they had. It was the people they interacted with, the place and the environment that they were around.
We got the wrong person in the chair. We needed her in here. You sound like she'd have something interesting to say.
Well, if you have a well-being podcast, she would be a fantastic person. There's many around, but Annie Horton is a really world expert. Her model's been the policy people in Manchester, UK, use her model to drive the well-being framework over there at that big city scale. So, I mean, there are other ways, and I think you're totally correct. You know, wellness is what I think we need to be talking more about rather than just economy.
Yeah, I think that's going to be an important focus. A few more quick questions. Here is a quick one, I hope. Will New Zealand have glaciers in the future? Now, obviously, we might be thinking about the ones that you can go and see from the roadside. Are they going to disappear entirely, Travis?
Yep.
Well, there you go. That's a short answer.
The problem with that is that those ice fields, snow fields, glaciers up in the Alps, that they provide a fair bit of the base flow to our rivers, which again is recharging our groundwater system and keeping Christchurch's drinking water supply as awesome as it currently is. You lose those glaciers, you lose a little bit of base flow. It's just less water to go around, beautiful clean water coming out of the Alps. So unfortunately, the current rate of warming, the current rate of glacial retreat, by and large, that they're not going to last too much longer. That said, New Zealand, it's surrounded by ocean and you get different behaviors in glacial systems depending on where you are specifically. And there's a lot of good science behind all that. But overall, they're not headed in the right direction.
All right. Well, the glaciers are gone, which, would be a tragedy in many ways. And those ice fields, I've been lucky enough to be on the top of the Tasman Glacier, right up on the saddle, and it's a real sight to behold. It'll be a tragedy.
It's going to have really significant practical impacts on our water resources.
And probably our last question we've got time for, which is something we really haven't talked about but probably should have, and that's kind of the Māori Indigenous people's perspective. The question is actually how will Labor forefront Indigenous perspectives for waterway regeneration? But I think one of the things we haven't talked about is the Indigenous perspective on all of these discussions we've been having today, and the fact that we've perhaps approached it historically with a particular mindset which hasn't taken into account not only to treaty obligations, but also the fact that the worldview that we bring to these questions might not be the only one. What do you think about that, Beatrix?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely agree. I think that's probably one of the bigger causes, especially when it comes to water pollution, in terms of not having involved local hapu, iwi, in discussions around water usage. And I think the answer to that comes with a word that's been a bit dirtied in recent years of co-governance. Before it got a bit warped over the last couple of years with Three Waters, but you look at Waihoro, Lake Ellesmere, and the group that is set up there in terms of its care is based on a co-governance model. And that's starting to make some progress there in terms of actually communicating with the local hapu around Indigenous practice and ways of actually restoring the water and keeping away kind of our more colonial views that have impacted that usage in the past.
But Travis?
I'm a big fan of Kepa Morgan's Māori model here. This is an approach where, in a semi-quantitative, semi-qualitative approach, talk to the locals, those who have the matananga around those systems, and ask them, how has it changed? So how is the life force, the Māori of this system, whether it be a water system, a land system, the birds, all of it together, te ao, Māori, the entire environment, how has it changed? Has it improved or has it gotten worse? And if you talk to enough people, you have a relative consensus around, yeah, no, it's getting better. Or, actually, the quality of that river has gone down. We don't have as many tuna. We don't have too much algae in it, and not enough clear flowing water. So by just having a Mātauranga and Indigenous knowledge-based system of monitoring, and monitoring the Māori and having councils, whether it be the city council, the regional council, the government, using that system, it necessarily is inclusive from the very beginning. You're talking to the hapu, the runanga, the iwi, the locals who have the knowledge, and you're taking a systems perspective or a worldview perspective that doesn't just isolate the things that more Western perspectives like to think about.
I mean, the Whanganui River is a fantastic example from certainly from my kind of legal background, where there's a legal recognition of the personality of the river itself. And of course, if you're giving the river a legal personality, it's kind of tricky to say you're going to trade off its health for some other interests. It kind of puts the whole discussion in a different perspective. And certainly co-governance has been bandied around, but the idea of sitting around the table with the people whose environment certainly we have arrived in seems a pretty reasonable idea to me.
Mm.
All right. I think we're there for today. So thanks very much. All right.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you.
Really good.
Cheers.
Right, Duncan, this is the time in the show where we hold you accountable. What have you got on this month? What are you doing?
Oh, heaps. I've got heaps on this month. Look, I've got to first of all, though, say that in Parliament, I've got my insurance contracts bill drawn. That's reforming the whole of insurance law. It's a members' bill. I've got to go around all of the other politicians and get support for it. That's going to be a real help for homeowners. But here in Christchurch, well, on 20th of April, I'll be in the Redwood Library at about, I think, 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and I'll be having a constituent clinic. So anyone who wants to come in and see me, feel free.
They can just drop in with any kind of questions, concerns, feedback.
Come and see what a politician looks like, have a chat, tell me what's going on in the community, ask a question.
Amazing. 20th of April.
That's right. And then I might be popping down to the Vegan Night Market in Phillipstown on 27th of April. That's always good down there. It's actually really good to go down, and you don't even have to be a vegan to go. and it's vegan, vegetarian food and a whole lot of market stalls and things like that. But it's really just good to go and socialise, but also to taste some food that, you know, sometimes you might not cook at home.
Yeah, and Phillipstown, a really fantastic community hub. They have their gala day on the 13th, obviously. That'll be in the past. But
that will be in the past in the future.
It will be, and they have a fantastic community garden, lots of events on.
No, Phillipstown's hub's great, whole lot of community groups there. It's actually just worth going down. They've got a kai cupboard as well. If you're there, there's food from the community and from the garden there.
Beautiful. And you've also got the Linwood Market coming up soon, don't you?
Linwood Market is on the first Saturday of every month, and the last one before winter will be coming up in early May.
Beautiful. And then, of course, another important date we have this month is
Anzac Day. Is always a special day, and as for every Anzac Day, I'll be at the dawn service in Cathedral Square at 6 a.m., and if you're in the Papanui area, I'll also be down at the Papanui RSA at 9:30, but both great services. If you're not an early riser, do try and get down to one of those services.
Definitely. And, of course, it's not just about what you're up to. It's what the Labor Party is up to too. Give me a little bit of a background of what's been going on in Parliament in the last wee while.
Oh, look, well, obviously, we've been pushing back on a lot of what this government's doing. I think now the funding cuts that the government's putting in place to fund tax cuts for landlords and other people is really biting. So if you might have heard about the disability allowances that are being cut, and we're seeing huge rounds of redundancies for some of our public services, and we've heard the police having a real arm wrestle over getting the pay rise that they were promised. And all of these things are really just going to put, you know, money in landlords' pockets. So about $3 billion going to landlords in the tax cuts there. So we've got some real concerns there.
Meanwhile, the landlords are getting tax cuts, I saw on News Hub the other day that the police were doing a bit of a round robin in the office to try and fundraise for someone's power bill.
Yeah, I mean, and that's outrageous.
It is.
It's a lot of our public servants do a lot of hard work, and there's a lot of narrative around it being back office workers, but the fact of the matter is that when the police cut their so-called back office workers, we're going to get frontline cops answering their emails, and it's just not good for anyone.
Yeah, definitely. What else is happening in Parliament currently?
Oh, look, Labor Party's initiated in government a review of greyhound racing. We want this government to ban greyhound racing. We've come out very clearly. It doesn't look like it can be done safely in a way that's humane for the dogs. The industry's had its chance, and we think Christopher Luxon and his coalition government should do what Christopher Luxon said he'd do prior to the election and actually stop greyhound racing. And, of course, the other thing that's going to be happening in the next couple of months is prescription fees are going to go up. Only last week I was talking to one of our local community chemists who was singing the praises of the doing away with prescription fees and saying how so many more people were able to get the healthcare that they needed, that frontline healthcare, and that's not going to happen once those prescription fees are cut. So another disappointment, all to save a few million dollars. And, of course, just got to give a shout out for the petition that's going around to save school lunches. A whole lot of schools, both in Christchurch and elsewhere, are getting free lunches. And it's not just about kids learning in schools. It's also just about making sure they're getting good nutrition and have full tummies. And the idea that you're going to cut costs and cut back on school lunches is just abhorrent to me. So please sign that petition as soon as you can.
Yeah, definitely. Thanks, Duncan.
Thanks, everyone, for tuning in. You've been listening to Legally Speaking with me, Duncan Webb. Thanks also to our guests, Travis Horton and Beatrix Gilling, and everyone who sent in questions. If you want to listen again, you can do that on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. And you can follow me on Facebook and Instagram. And if you want to, you can send in questions and ideas for new topics. Next month, we'll be discussing firearms. Ka kite.
Legally Speaking is funded by Parliamentary Services.